We had come then to the period of time that begins the 1100s when we see the non-Catholic Christians, and I've used that term many times through the semester, non-Catholic Christians becoming a much stronger group in Europe. In the 11, 12, 13, and 1400s, off and on, there are very large groups of people. And we have probably come to the time, although again it is difficult to pinpoint it, but we have probably at about this time come to the time that we would define as the Thyatira era of the church. So I wanted to read that section from the Bible in Revelation, where we have the story from the biblical point of view, from the prophecy of that phase of the church. And this is number 4 out of the 7 churches. So it kind of comes in the middle. It's the middle or fulcrum of the time of the churches that would go from the time of Christ until the time of his second coming. Revelation 2, the whole last half of the chapter is devoted to this group of people who are symbolized by the city of Thyatira. Thyatira was characterized by its trades. It was the city of cloth, of dyeing clothing, of weaving materials. In fact, they were known as weavers, tradespeople who worked with cloth, clothing, tailoring, weaving, that type of thing. This was the ancient city of Thyatira in Asia Minor, and it was famous for its purple. Remember Lydia in the Bible, in the book of Acts, who was a dyer of clothing, of precious dye called, I've forgotten the name of it now, and it was purple anyway. It made out of a particular seashell that was very rare. This was the city of Thyatira. To the angel of that church, God inspired Christ to have this message written. Thus says, these things says the Son of God, who has his eyes like unto flame of fire and his feet like unto brass. I know your works and your charity, your service and faith and your patience. So there is a work that goes on here. And you see that a little bit more than perhaps in some of the other eras of the church, save maybe Ephesus and Philadelphia. There is a period of resurgence in this era of the church. There's service, faith, patience, because of course they are still in the wilderness. Remember, they are still persecuted. They have been driven away into the wilderness in the 4th, 5th, and 6th centuries, remaining in the valleys and remote regions. They are to a degree coming out of those remote regions into some of the towns and villages in the Thyatira period, not so much in the large cities, although to a small degree they do. But they have to be patient because it's not now the time for them to really break forth. And of their works, he said, the last would be more than the first. So as we start out, and it's very difficult, again, to pinpoint this, but let's say in the 900s or 1000 period of time, maybe even 1100, we could start the Thyatira era. It's just impossible to pinpoint it. In that period of time, we get a start of it, though, and we come into a period of time in the 1200s. We'll talk about, not today, we won't get that far, in the work of Peter Waldo and the work of the Waldenses or Waldensians, their works were much greater than those that preceded them. Prior to the time, it began to be persecuted even more and move into England and finally to the New World, which would take several more centuries. So it's, again, impossible to know the beginning and the end, but if we begin it around 1000 or 11, sorry about that, I'm distracted by your killing the flea or the fly or the bug or whatever it was. Somebody slapped a fly on the back of another student, and my train of thought's gone. So I just regather myself here. I wonder if somebody's getting beat up back there. Right here in the class. Persecution of true Christians. So if we could begin it as early as 1000, and thus the work of Waldo in the 1200s and those that succeeded him would be considered to be last, greater than the first. On the other hand, if the work of the Waldensian church goes on for another couple of hundred years after Waldo, it's difficult to see how those last works were greater than the work that he did, because he was an outstanding personality, unless you just consider what went on, the extension of his work. But again, that's not clearly given to us to understand. However, there are, as in most cases, and Christ gives these instructions to the churches, some weaknesses that each of these time periods had. And the big problem that this particular group of people had to deal with was Jezebel, the woman. Now, we would obviously presume that this ancient queen who married into the Israelitish family and brought pagan religion in the days of Ahab, would symbolize, at this period of time, the Roman Catholic Church. The woman, a loose or immoral woman, as Jezebel was, bringing in paganism, would seem a rather strong possibility that that's what this symbolism is. I don't know any other, in fact. You suffer that woman, Jezebel, who calls herself a prophetess. Who is this false woman? There really isn't anybody else. We have no other option than to see this as the great church that had risen now over the last hundreds of years and now was in absolute power in Europe during this period of time. And you have to live in that configuration, with this domination of the Catholic system, its control of religion certainly, and politics to a very large degree. I have a few things against you. You permit that woman Jezebel, who calls herself a prophetess, to teach and to seduce my servants and to commit fornication and to eat things sacrificed to idols. They had a very difficult time completely coming out of the Roman system. And so while they were up and down through this period of time, and we're dealing with 200, 300, 400 years, don't forget, there were periods of time when they were stronger, periods of time when they were weaker, but overall, they had a very difficult time leaving behind the doctrines of the Catholic Church because they were forced into it. I mean, it was at gunpoint. And you could say, well, what else could they do? Well, God would have said, as in the case of some, there were faithful martyrs, people who were willing to die once they knew what to do. I gave her space to repent of her fornication, but she didn't. So there was a time. She could have done better. She could have chosen to die, but in some cases they just didn't do it, and they perpetuated some of the doctrine, some of the way. They were faithful in some areas, and they worked. They spread the gospel, but they just couldn't completely give it all up. Behold, I will cast her into a bed, and them that commit adultery with her into great tribulation, except they repent of their deeds. And of course they did. They had to suffer. I think I've already mentioned to you, but we'll repeat again, that it is in this period of time that the Catholic Church launches the Crusades. Some of the Crusades, originating in Europe, first of all, were designed to extricate heretics out of the villages on the way down to the Holy Land. And then, a little later on, about the turn of the next century into the 1200s, the infamous Inquisition was instituted by the Catholic Church to flush out the heretics and to kill them. They suffered great tribulation. Nobody knows how many thousands, maybe scores of thousands, of Christians who were not Catholics were killed by the Crusaders and the Inquisitors of Europe from about 1100 to 1300. It was a terrifying time. That's, again, off and on. And they were told that this would happen to them. We had come to verse 23. I will kill her children with death, and all the churches shall know that I am he who searches the reins and hearts, and I will give unto every one of you according to your works. So there would be many in Thyatira who are willing to die. We'll probably have the appropriate reward. Well, we'll have the appropriate reward in the kingdom. There were others perhaps too weak to remain faithful. I don't know that they've sealed their eternal fate, but at least they did not maintain the faith in some cases. I say unto you, I say, and to the rest in Thyatira, as many as have not this doctrine, and which have not known the depths of Satan as they speak, I will put upon you no other burden, as they just seem to have a responsibility to perpetuate what truth they knew. They were not to carry the gospel of the kingdom of God to the world in the same way the Philadelphia church did. There would be an open door laid before it. We'll come to that, of course. These people struggled to live just to maintain life and some purity of doctrine. But it was not required of them to do anything more than that. That which you have already, hold fast till I come. He that overcomes and keeps my works to the end, I will give power over the nations. and he will rule them with a rod of iron. The vessels of the potter shall they be broken. So you're familiar with that. We so often turn to that verse, but you should relate it to specifically to the Thyatira people. They did have a great deal of overcoming, and some of them, of course, are going to have very important positions in God's work because they did. Now, we basically have moved out of Eastern Europe now by 1100. People have been persecuted there and or through their evangelistic zeal have moved into the heartland of Europe, and we will now see them called by a variety of names. And at this place, perhaps more than any other, from 1100 to the Protestant Reformation, the vast bulk of material we have is by Catholic persecutors of the church. Very little other evidence. The most prominent name that we will find non-Catholic Christians referred to in this period of time is given to them by an area of southern France where they lived. It was ALBI, the region, Albi, a geographic center, and they were called, after the name of that geographic area, Albigenses, Albigenses. We pick up that name in the 1100s. And here is what McClenics and Strong's Biblical Encyclopedia says. McClenic and Strong's Biblical Encyclopedia. What these bodies held in common and what made them equally the prey of the Inquisitor was their unwavering belief in the corruption of the medieval church, especially as governed by the Roman pontiffs. Now, after we finish going through this period of time where we're going to be talking about God's true church for two or three classes now, through 1100 on to 1400, then I'll go back and fill in what was happening throughout this whole period of time within the confines of the Roman Catholic Church. It was truly corrupt during this period of time. And the one common denominator of these groups of persecuted peoples was they abhorred the corruption of the Catholic system and what the priests were doing, what the church was forcing upon people, the sway they held in people's lives. Now, of course, that brings persecution upon you by the state religion, the Catholic Church, and everything they get from you and what they write about you has to be taken with that in mind, as it will note. By some writers, their origin is traced to the Paulicians or Bogomils, who, having withdrawn from Bulgaria and Thrace, either to escape persecution or, more probably, from motives of zeal to extend their doctrines, settled in various parts of Europe. They acquired different names in different countries. As in Italy, where they originally migrated, they were called Patarini or Cathari, and I've mentioned both those names in a previous class. In France, they are called Albigensi. So here are small groups of people, nevertheless making significant impact, in fact growing into such numbers that they become a problem to the Catholic Church. Now you know that it's more than a half a dozen people in a little village in southern France, if that's the case. You aren't going to organize an entire army against six people. You know, these now are numbering into the hundreds, possibly the thousands or even scores of thousands spread around. I think scores would probably be an exaggeration. But significant enough thousands of people were parts of these movements that the Catholic Church has to attempt to stamp them out of existence. And the Encyclopedia Britannica, 11th edition again, says of them, "The heresy which had penetrated into these regions, probably by trade routes, came originally from Eastern Europe. The name of Bulgarians was often applied to the Albigenses, because they came out of Bulgaria and were called Bulgars over there. We talked about that last class. And they always kept up their intercourse with the Bogomil sectaries of Thrace." So these peoples of Europe maintained contact with the movements out of northern Turkey into southeastern Europe, now into western Europe, and there's still a link, even as late as 1100. There are still peoples living in the east, but the primary center of the movement's now coming into France and Italy during this period of time. What is certain is that there, above all, formed an anti-sacerdotal party in permanent opposition to the Roman Church and raised a continued protest against the corruption of the clergy of their time. Their dualist doctrines, as described by controversialists, presented numerous resemblances to those of the Bogomils, and even more specifically to those of the Paulicians, with whom they are sometimes connected. So every time you read about them, you see the link. From Paulician to Bogomil to Albigensi, and or whatever name you pick it up. Cathar, Patarine, all these other names in Europe. It is exceedingly difficult, however, to form any very precise idea of the Albigensian doctrines, as our knowledge of them is derived from their opponents, and the very rare texts emanating from the Albigenses, which have come down to us, contain very inadequate information concerning their metaphysical principles and moral practice. So again, that demonstrates the difficulty of studying church history. Even the great researchers of the Encyclopedia at Work said, you just can't know for sure, but here's what we can gather out of reading about those. Now, this term dualism continually crops up as we read about the non-Catholic Christians. That should not be surprising, because there is a concept of the Bible of good and evil. There is a great God who is good, and there is a satanic rebel who is evil, and demons who are evil, and angels who are good, and mankind does good and evil. So if you listen to the expounding of a doctrine, let's say you heard Mr. Armstrong's sermon about Satan's rebellion and how the power of God and what happened, you, if you had been educated in certain dualistic principles, you might say, well, they're obviously a dualistic sect. That is, the good versus evil battle. Now, dualism, as we would classically define it, we don't believe in, which embraces, of course, the concept of an immortal soul that is good, imprisoned within a mortal body, which is evil. That's the basic root of dualism. But you keep seeing this term. I think we could understand it without any major difficulty, because it would even in some cases be applied to us. We do find that among these groups of people, they lived very strict ascetic lives in many cases. But we also know that there are two categories of people. That is, those who dedicate themselves to the evangelistic ministry, as it were, or the priesthood. That would be the Catholic way to phrase it, who are a higher class, let's say, of people, or standards, more rigid standards imposed upon them, and then the general population of the group, wherever they may live. So when you read about them, you're going to find a very ascetic group of people being described by the Catholics. They fasted frequently. Some of the articles about the Albigenses, they were willing to fast until they died. Now, this does not sound like a very sound, mentally, way to approach life. Whether they did that or not, I don't know. But that's what their persecutors said about them, that they were willing to fast until they died. And in many cases, although by no means all, as we'll see as we go along today, their level of ministers were celibate, as the Catholic priesthood was. They did not marry. Others among the ministry of the church and some of their leadership were very strongly in favor of marriage. In fact, required marriage as a part of their doctrine, as an opposition to the Catholic Church. In a work called The Pilgrim Church by Broadbent, I think I have quoted that work a few times before, The Pilgrim Church by Broadbent, we read of the Albigenses. This name, Albigenses, does not appear until after the council held at Lombards near Albi about the middle of the 12th century. So we pick this name up in the middle of the 1100s as far as the literature about them. Among the people and brethren, they were most frequently called the good men. There is a general testimony to the fact that their manner of life was a pattern to all, and especially the simplicity and piety were a contrast to the self-indulgence of the clergy. Now, at this particular period of time in history, the Roman Catholic clergy were landowners. They were very wealthy. They were barons and earls and dukes, and controlled small armies of their own within the confines of these great European estates, which were owned by the church and controlled by the clergy. And, of course, they imposed their will upon the people by means of this little army or military force that they had, in addition to their own powers of the ministry. The contrast was so noticeable that the ministers of the Albigensi, or the Cathars, or these other groups, were very simplistic. They didn't live in that same lifestyle. some among the brethren devoted themselves entirely to traveling and ministering to the word. They were called the perfect. And in accordance with the Lord's words in Matthew 19, if you will be perfect, go and sell all that you have and give to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven. They possessed nothing. They had no home. They literally acted upon this command. Now, we do not feel that that command is what Christ meant for the ministry of the church to always, at all times, abide by. I won't go into a doctrinal exposition of that. Nor did the New Testament ministry understand it that way. That was for the purpose of that one tour Christ sent them on for a short period of time, not for the way he intended the ministry to always be as a general command. But you read the Bible in this time frame, and you could see, giving the contrast of the Catholic clergy, why one might choose to live that way. The congregations of believers who met apart from the Catholic Church were numerous and increasing. You see, what was happening in the 1100s is a resurgent, large numbers of people. They are often called Albigenses, a name taken from Albi, a district where there were many of them. But this name was never used by them, nor of them until a later period. They had intimate connections with brethren called Waldenses, the Poor Men of Lyons, Bogle Mills, and other names, in the surrounding countries where churches spread among various peoples. So we have church congregations being raised up in this period of time. Ministers, traveling evangelists, in significant enough numbers that the Catholic Church has to finally wage war against them, literally. So it's not a small thing. In the Encyclopedia of Religion and Ethics, the authors write of Gibbon argued that the persons called Albigenses in the south of France were basically Paulician immigrants. In all essentials, says Lay, that is an author, the doctrine of the Paulicians was identical to that of the Albigenses. So again, you see the link that keeps the movement going. By 1098... I've mentioned this before, but we come to the time period now. By the year 1098, the Albigenses, who were not yet called this, but called by a variety of other names, the First Crusade is organized. The First Crusade. And it starts in Europe with priests being sent into various towns to find heretics. And in order for them to confess their heresies, subjecting them to terrible persecution, confiscation of property, torture where necessary, in order to find out who they are. But this doesn't work. That's 1098. 100 years later, 1198, the Pope at Rome is Innocent III, who is anything but innocent. Innocent III comes to the papacy in 1198, and he institutes the Inquisition, which you've all heard about, I would imagine, as one of this world's history's most tragic events, the Inquisition. It was instituted that through whatever means possible to convert heretics back to the Catholic Church or into the Catholic Church if they were never part of it. That was the purpose of the Inquisition. And I think I may have mentioned a time or two before, the basic philosophy and justification for that goes all the way back to Augustine and his City of God philosophy, that the church is the kingdom of God on the earth, and that it is the responsibility of the church to bring people into the church, and that if you are not part of the church, and the immortal soul doctrine comes into this, and the baptism doctrine comes into this, you see how you start to build your premise and your doctrines and your practices on false concepts, you draw terribly wrong conclusions. You start with an immortal soul and original sin and the City of God and all of these things that are totally incorrect, purgatory, heaven and hell, absolutely erroneous doctrine, leads you to be able, by the year 1200, to round it out, by the year 1200, the Catholic Church can justify putting a person to death in order to get him to become converted. And the whole theory is that you're going to, as I mentioned before, I think, you're going to burn in hell anyway if you don't get converted. If you aren't baptized, your soul is going to go to hell anyway. If we can, through whatever means, stretch you on the rack and make you recant of your heresy, bring you into the church and get you to accept the church and be baptized or whatever is necessary, you at least get to go to purgatory if it's with your dying breath that we accomplish this. And if you die, it doesn't matter because you were going to hell anyway. So that's that, you know. What a diabolical doctrine that is. And we bring the world into the darkest of the dark ages with the Crusades and the Inquisition. The 1000s, 1100s, well, 1100s, 1200s, 1300s, terrifying time in human history. Midnight of the Dark Ages, as one Protestant writer said, and I think that's a good way to phrase it. The midnight of the Dark Ages, this period of time in which these terrible things are happening to people. Continuing in the Encyclopedia, or no, this I guess, yeah, the Encyclopedia of Religion and Ethics. In the beginning of the 13th century, the Albigenses had become a threat to the very existence of the church in southern France. Powerful movement, you see. Now, I'm not saying all Albigenses are true Christians. This is very difficult to pinpoint. I'm just showing that there is, at this point, a very strong anti-Catholic movement. And if there were God's people among them, this almost assuredly is what they would be called. But they may not be part of the greater group of Albigenses. One just doesn't know. The very existence of the Catholic Church in southern France was threatened at the beginning of the 13th century. Innocent III at first attempted to convert the heretics by sending preachers into their infected areas. But sermons and disputations seemed ineffective. When the papal legate Peter of Castelnau was murdered in the year 1208, the Pope decided that the use of force was justified and launched a crusade against the recalcitrant Albigenses. During the next 10 years, the army, led by Simon de Montfort, forced the surrender of the most important heretical strongholds, employing in the process methods that were cruel even by medieval standards. Fighting continued until 1229, but its purpose became political, and they incorporated Languedoc into France, the geographical region. Once deprived of baronial protection, the Albigenses found it necessary to flee or to go underground. Their final extirpation was accomplished by the Inquisition established by Gregory IX in 1233. By the end of the 14th century, their power was completely broken. And we lose the name from history, Albigenses and some of these others too. Not all of them are lost now. Waldenses perpetuate themselves and are in existence till this very day. But you don't find Albigenses in the world today. You don't find Cathars and Paterines and Patagenes and some of these other names. They just were extirpated during that period of time, and they were brought back into the Catholic Church, or they fled and were persecuted and simply died out because there was no way to perpetuate their numbers. But it took 200 years for the Catholic Church to do this, through the most horrifying period of time you can imagine. God's church was indeed still in the wilderness, as we have seen that they had to be during that period of time. Continuing, in 1214, Innocent rescinded the prohibition to preach the crusade, and in the course of the year, 100,000 pilgrims poured into Languedoc. Their first military achievement was the capture of Morillac, on which occasion we find a reference to the Waldenses, seven of whom were burnt with great joy as incorrigible in the attestation of their errors. So the Catholics moved thousands of people into these communities to overwhelm them with numbers. With the exception of the charge of, this is from another work, this is from McClintock and Strong now, Biblical Encyclopedia. With the exception of the charge of rejecting marriage, no allegation is made against their morals by the better class of Roman writers. Their constancy was suffering in suffering excited the wonders of their opponents. Tell me, Holy Father, says one of the writers, relating to the martyrdom of three of these heretics, how is this? They entered to the stake and bore the torment of the fire, not only with patience, but with joy and gladness. I wish your explanation, how these members of the devil could persist in their heresy with a courage and constancy scarcely to be found in the most religious of the faith of Christ. So they're zeal and their bravery was to be admired, and even their Catholic tormentors wrote to the Pope and said, how could this be? How could these people be of the devil when they're willing to go through this for the sake of their beliefs? And yet it was perceived that they were of the devil. So that'll give you a good summary of the Albigenses, and I spend a little more time on them because there is more available. So as you do your own study and research at some point out in the future, it would be a key name, as opposed, let's say, to this next group that I already mentioned last class, the Pasagini. P-A-S-A-G-I-N-I, and that has a variety of endings on it, depending on which language. These groups of Pasagini existed in the 1100s in Europe, and they become a very interesting group, but so little is known of them, because here is a group of Judaizing Christians, believing in the obligation of the Old Testament upon Christianity, with the exception of the sacrificial ritual. And you'd certainly have to presume that this group of Christians would be very strongly a part of the true church. Here is what the Encyclopedia of Religious Knowledge by Brown says about them, Pasaginians. Encyclopedia of Religious Knowledge by Brown. A denomination which arose in the 12th century were sometimes called the circumcised. Mosheim, I've quoted him before, an eminent church historian who has a work that I've mentioned would be good for you to own on your own, if you can find it sometime, the church historian Mosheim. Mosheim says, quote, "The meaning of the term Pasaginian is unknown, but it seems to have been a remnant of the Nazarenes." Now you make a nice connection all the way from 1100 clear back to the earliest age of the church. They seem to have been a remnant of the Nazarenes, and they have these distinguishing tenets. One, they observe the law of Moses in everything except the offering of sacrifices, to be obligatory upon Christians. And two, they believe that Christ was no more than the first and purest creature of God, which was the doctrine of the Semi-Arians. So they may not have fully understood all things, or their doctrines may have been misinterpreted, after all, because we have been misinterpreted when we say that Jesus Christ came and was completely mortal, and that Christ was, in that sense of the word, born again. That is, he had to be raised from the dead and given spirit life. So we won't worry about that. But a very interesting group of people. There's another group of people in Italy called the Patarines, P-A-T-A-R-I-N-E-S, Patarines. A movement from Milan. This is from a dictionary of religion, the Encyclopedic Dictionary of Religion. They were members of a movement in Milan against simony, that is, the purchase of a church office by money, which the Catholic clergy was guilty of, and the concubinage of the clergy, even though the clergy at this time were supposed to be living celibate. They were living with concubines by the dozens. It was a time of great sexual immorality among the hierarchy of the Catholic Church. And some of them had even dozens of illegitimate children, some of the Catholic priests. The quarter of the city where they meet, Patara, is probably the origin of the name. This is in Milan. Most of the members were simply laymen. In their zeal against abuses of the clergy, they had the support of Pope Stephen IX and Alexander II. They refused to receive the sacraments from simoniacal bishops and priests. Sometimes they even used physical force to remove unworthy clergy. I'm not sure this would be something God would have his ministers do, so I don't know whether these are or not, but they were strong enough in some sections that they could actually force the clergy out of the church, the Catholic clergy, and to do other things. Of this group of people in Italy and in southern France, the Dictionary of Sects and Heresies says, "They observe the law of Moses, except for sacrifices, practice circumcision, the Sabbath, distinction of clean and unclean foods, all forming part of the system, and hence they were often called circumcisi," the Latin or Italian name for circumcision. "The Pasagians appealed to the scriptures of the Old and New Testament in support of their doctrine. They gave the chief authority for their history as bona cursus in the 1400s. From the same book, Patarini, an Italian name for the Paulicians, migrated from Bulgaria to Italy in the 7th century. So you have a reference in the 1400s that traces this group of people back to the same ones we've been talking about all this time. But there is practically nothing else about them. So we don't know enough to even make authoritative comments. Now, in this same period of time, we come to three very interesting personalities, which I am not thoroughly convinced we could say are God's true ministers, but I suppose the possibility exists. I wish we knew more. Of the three, and I'll mention them all now, probably have to continue next class, of the three, the first one is more likely to be one we would associate with God's true church. His name was Peter DeBries. Peter, D-E, sometimes spelled D-U, depending on the book you're reading, B-R-U-Y-S, Bries, Peter DeBries. And he comes into the picture in the early 1100s, probably dies in the 1120s or 30s, the date is unclear. He begins his work in the south of France, around the turn of the 1100s, and he may be the one referred to there where the begin in Revelation, the beginning of his works were good, but the latter works would be greater. So if we can define that period of time, you might say the work of Peter DeBries might be the beginning work referred to there, and the work of Peter Waldo, the latter work. So we have Peter DeBries. There were two men who followed him in the work in France that was done, and there's questionable material about them. One was named Arnold, Arnold of Bresca, B-R-E-S-C-A, Arnold of Bresca, and the other was simply called Henry, with an I on the end, H-E-N-R-I, or Henri, if you prefer. That's probably very bad French, but we have these three personalities, Peter DeBries, Arnold, and Henry. You might guess that their followers were often called after the name of these leaders. So you have Petrobrusians, who are followers of Peter DeBries, Petrobrusians, all one word, Arnoldists, for those who followed Arnold, and Henrythians, for those who followed Henry. That would be like today, people sometimes call us Armstrongites. I haven't heard anybody try to give Mr. Tkach a title yet in that regard from the outside. What do you call us? Tkachoviches or Tkachovites, using the Russian, huh? Well, we're not Armstrongites. They weren't Petrobrusians, Arnoldists, or Henrythians. But that's what people call them. So if you want to study about them, that's what you'll have to look up. So if you're looking in the reference works and the encyclopedias or in the indexes of books, these are words, either the name of the person, Peter DeBries, Arnold or Henry, or their movements that people call them. And these are the dominant personalities from about 1100 into 1150, 60, along in there. So this precedes Peter Waldo, who does not come on the scene until about 1200, late in the 1100s, and rounds out into the 1200s. So you have a period of a good 100 years in there where we have these outstanding personalities. And what we find about them that they are, more than anything else, what is most known about them is their strong anti-Catholic stance. They are very opposed to the development of what has happened in the Catholic Church during this period of time. One of the persecutors of Peter DeBries, in fact, one of the Catholic priests wrote about him and called him that wretched little man. So apparently he wasn't a large man. Some of the things they believed, there are five major doctrines we can isolate about the Petrobrusians and Peter DeBries. They baptized only mature adults who had understanding, so they rejected infant baptism, which the Catholic Church had now long since begun to practice, although they did not always. But now centuries have gone by. The Petrobrusians denied infant baptism. They believed it was idle superstition to build churches. The Catholic Church, during this whole period of time, were building these monumental buildings of Europe. If you go to Europe today and you view and see them, or the Holy Land, beginning way back in the 300s and now continuing, even in the most impoverished of times, the Catholic Church managed to build some of these great cathedrals that are here and there all over Europe. The Petrobrusians believed that that was not the correct thing to do. They had an abhorrence for crucifixes.
or cross worship, would refuse to use it as a Christian sign. Peter DeBry said the cross should be hated as an instrument of torture, which we totally agree with. I mean, we do not venerate the cross. It was an object of Christ's death and crucifixion, not something to honor. So they abhorred crucifixes or any use of the cross. And in fact, so much so that they tore down crosses. And in city squares and off churches, and if they were made of wood, burned them. This unfortunately got Peter DeBry's, cost him his life. One day a group of his followers went into a town, St. Gilles, I don't know where that is, and they tore down some crosses and put them into a great pyre in the middle of town and started them on fire. And the Catholics rushed upon them, took Peter DeBry's, and burnt him in the fire he had built of crosses. So he might have been a bit overzealous in what he did, but he just felt, you know, that was something to do. He could not stand the veneration of crosses, and it ultimately cost him his life. The fourth doctrine that you find among them, that they did not believe in the doctrine of transubstantiation. That is, that the body and blood of Christ do not literally become that in the symbol of the wine and the bread. And the fifth thing we can clearly see about them, they did not believe in prayer or any other kind of good work for the dead. This had become a great Catholic tradition in this period of time. Prayers for the dead. It remains, of course, something that is a common part of the Catholic Church to this very day. Unfortunately, we do not find any major evidence of their Sabbath and Sunday observances among the Petrobrusians. That's why it's very difficult to say authoritatively that Peter DeBry's was a minister of God's true church. In our earlier writings that we have written, and I will consult with Dr. Hay on this before putting it down in print, to see what other evidences we might have, but in our earlier literature we distinctly state that we do feel he was, and we don't know of any reason not to put him down. The Catholic Church would not want to have given any strong evidence of Sabbath keeping, perhaps, during this period of time, or Satan just simply let it be kept unknown, so that it could not be documented, and God permitted that to occur. There are many possibilities. But the Petrobrusians, we do not find clear evidence of their Sabbath observance that I am aware of. In my studies, I have not found them. But the very fact that they were such a strong anti-Catholic movement and they understood so much of the Bible, one might certainly conclude that it would be logical that they do this. Well, I better break it off there because I've got a number of longer things to discuss with you about these men. And we'll round the corner then into the 1200s and the life of Peter Waldo in the next class.